Welcome to Pardes Daily, where you get your daily dose of Torah with Pardes faculty. This month, Pardes is bringing Elul to you. Let's dive in.
Hi, this is Rachel Berkovitz coming to you from Jerusalem. This is Unit 13 of 20, in which we're learning through all the Mishnayot of Masechet Rosh Hashanah. Last time, we stopped right in the middle of four different Mishnayot that discussed what this shofar is, what kind of animal it could be used, it can come from, what type of ceremonies it's used in, and we had just learned that in Mishnah 3 that the shofar of an ibex, a simple ibex, is the essential mitzvah on the day of Rosh Hashanah, where the silver trumpet, although it has accompanying it a curled, humbled ram's horn, on the fast day, it's really the trumpet that is the essential mitzvah. And then we get to Mishnah 5, that is part of this whole section. Mishnah 5 says the following: Shaveh hayovel l'Rosh Hashanah l'tkia v'lebrachot. Yovel, remember we talked about this last time, the Jubilee year, that proclaiming of freedom throughout the land in which debts are reneged and land goes back to its original owner. Shaveh, equal. The Jubilee is equal to Rosh Hashanah. Equal, I think, means the same. The Jubilee is the same as Rosh Hashanah when it comes to the tkia, when it comes to the blast. So here's our first mention of this word tkia, right? We said in the Torah it said truah, and now we have the word tkia, the name of the blast, or maybe the sound of the blast. So it's the same type of blasting that happens on Rosh Hashanah and Yovel. And from the second part of the Mishnah, we're going to understand it means, what do I mean the same type of blast? I mean from the same type of animal. Presumably, the shape of the shofar, right? I'm not a musical person, but I'm assuming that the shape of the shofar creates a different sound. And so if I have a short, straight shofar, it's going to be more of a, like, maybe a one type of blast, less, I realize I don't know what the type of blast is. Musical person, contact me and explain me the difference of the sound. And if I have a more rounded, kofuf, bent down, twisted, circular sound of a ram's horn, it's going to be a different sound of the blast. And so this anonymous first opinion in our Mishnah says that the sound of the blast on Rosh Hashanah is going to be the sound of the same blast as on Yovel. And therefore, i.e. on Yovel, I'm going to use the short, simple ibex horn to blow. And not only is the Yovel equal to Rosh Hashanah when it comes to tekiot, the type of horn that I blow and when I blow them, but also with brachot, with the blessings. Now, up until now, we haven't been told in the Mishnah that there are any brachot said on Rosh Hashanah. In fact, this theme is going to be expanded in great detail in the fourth chapter of Masechet Rosh Hashanah, right? And the Mishnah uses the word brachot, but we think of brachot more as the word tefillah, right? Tefillah is made up of brachot, right? Even when we talk about the regular weekday tefillah, we call it the Shmona Esrei, the 18. It's 18 brachot because brachot make up the tefillah. And so when they're referring to the brachot, they're referring to the tefillah. We're referring to another aspect, a new dimension that we found out happens on Rosh Hashanah. So whatever tefillot and tekiot happen on Rosh Hashanah, the same ones, it's the equivalent ones, happen on Yovel, i.e. whatever is happening on Yovel is happening on Rosh Hashanah, and this Mishnah creates a link between the two of them. There is a dispute here. There is a dispute, and it says the following: Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Barosh Hashanah tokim b'shel zecharim, ubo yovel b'shel ye'alim. Rabbi Yehuda says, I disagree. You think that on Rosh Hashanah you blow with an ibex, and therefore on Jubilee you also blow with an ibex. But I say no. I actually think on Rosh Hashanah, so this, not only does he disagree with hey, he's actually disagreeing with Gimel, with three. He thinks that on Rosh Hashanah you blow with a ram's horn. You don't blow with an ibex. I.e., I think that Rosh Hashanah is the same as Ta'anit, as fast day, because that's where they blowed with the ram's horn, with the zachar. And on Yovel, that's when you blow with the ibex, okay? So he has broken the link between Rosh Hashanah and Jubilee and said, rather, I think that the link is between Rosh Hashanah and Ta'anit. And by the way, on the Jubilee, they blow with a different horn. Or I guess he agrees, because the Tanna Kamma also thinks on Jubilee you blow with an ibex. So they both agree that the Jubilee you blow with an ibex. They just disagree about which one is Rosh Hashanah connected to. Where the Tanna Kamma thinks Rosh Hashanah is connected to Yovel, and Rabbi Yehuda thinks Rosh Hashanah is connected to Ta'anit, that the shofar in Rosh Hashanah is connected to Ta'anit. Okay, and that's the end of Mishnah 5. What we see from this is that the connection between Rosh Hashanah and either the model of fast day or the model of the Jubilee is essential, and people disagree about it, and the type of horn you're blowing is essential to describing something of the experience. And so if we're trying to understand what is this blowing that happens on Rosh Hashanah, comparing it to either of these two models will emphasize something about the experience, what the experience is supposed to be. So in some ways, it's interesting. I feel like Rabbi Yehuda's view is maybe more like what we hear about if you were like in grade school or in Hebrew school, what they told you Rosh Hashanah was about. Right. He says Rosh Hashanah is, I blow it with the zachar. The zachar is the one that the word kafuf, that I'm bent down, I'm humbled, I'm in supplication, right? And I'm, it's like a fast day when I'm crying out to the divine to avert the punishment of the drought that I've been receiving, right? And this makes us think of that Mishnah at the beginning of the whole entire tractate that I said, like, it mentioned that the world is judged, and Rosh Hashanah, everyone walks before the divine, and then we get judged on Sukkot about the water. And so it sounds, and we talked about there, that possibly human action affects what's going to happen, if water is going to happen or not. And there was the attribute that Rosh Hashanah was like a day of judgment. And here too, it seems like that I'm fasting because I realize that there has been a divine judgment decreed on human beings, right? And that's why it's already Cheshvan, it's already Kislev, and I don't have any rain, and it's the rainy season, and I need the rain for my crops to grow, and I'm not going to have anything to eat if crops don't grow. And so I sound this cry out to the divine, a cry of listen, oh no, we must have done something wrong. And obviously we're fasting at the same time. So it's an experience of shofar that is one of recognizing judgment and trying to beseech that the judgment be changed. And maybe we haven't gotten to the concept really of tshuva, but possibly we're showing that we're trying to rectify our behavior by fasting and hoping that rain will come. So if I identify, like Rabbi Yehuda does, the shofar on Rosh Hashanah with that experience, that's one view of what maybe Rosh Hashanah is about. However, the majority view does not identify Rosh Hashanah that way, right? The majority view identifies Rosh Hashanah as being linked to the Yovel, as being linked to this Jubilee, right? And Jubilee is, you ready? Jubilation is one of joy, right? And I'm blowing a short horn that maybe has a more joyous, not that mellow cry to it, but a more joyous cry to it. And I'm proclaiming freedom for all on the Jubilee. And so possibly if I say I have the same tekiot and the same brachot as I do on the Jubilee every Rosh Hashanah, right? And I think back to that image of everyone going before the divine in Rosh Hashanah. And we talked about that maybe was a slightly more universal aspect here too. The Jubilee is an equalizer, right? And we have the word shaveh, which means equal here, right? Of saying there aren't hierarchies between human beings, and everyone deserves to be a landowner, and everyone deserves to have money and be able to live in a healthy way. And we don't want people to have hierarchies over one another and rule over one another. And it's a very different when I proclaim the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, and I'm imagining it's like a mini Jubilee, right? That's a much more joyous occasion, right? I think that this is linked to still understanding that the divine is the ruler in the world, right? Why do I want an equalizer between human beings? why do I want the lands for back to Kilu, the original human owner, right? And if I think the Jubilee is on part of the Shemitah, the sabbatical cycle, is an acknowledgement that ultimately there's only one ruler in the world, and that's the divine, right? And I need to reset when I have too much human hubris of thinking that they're land ownerships and they rule over people. I need to reset that. And I declare freedom amongst all individuals, but everyone is free because the divine is the one who ruled. And you can actually, if you read through carefully the verses about the Jubilee, I think you see that idea presented there, that there's ultimately only one Yachid, if we're thinking about the divine ruler, and therefore there has to be equal between all human beings. And so then there's an aspect of Rosh Hashanah as meaning more as proclaiming the divine is the only one, and then an equality between human beings. Okay, and these are two models that the Mishnah presents for what the shofar is. I actually think by presenting both of them and having Rabbi Yehuda disagree with the Tanakhama, it maybe wants to say that there's actually aspects of both of these models. There's the sounding of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah is like the shofar on the Ta'anit, on the fast day, and is like the shofar on the Jubilee. And both of those are experiences of the shofar. And then we get like an interesting mix of the experience of it being somewhat joyous and exciting and wonderful, but somehow awe-inspiring and sad and humbling. And both of those experiences of acknowledging the divine king, which we're going to see in the fourth chapter, as well as sort of the humbleness of human beings are represented in both. There's a problem with these four Mishnayot as well. It's, they seem to present all different, like, the first Mishnah said all shofarot are okay, but then it said specifically Rosh Hashanah should be either with an ibex or with a ram. And what's going on here with all these different views? So you could read it as each Mishnah is like, you know, a different Tana. It's really a different Tana, and they got all brought together and they don't have to have some unified view. You could read it that, so this is how the halakha wants to read it, that there's like an ideal. The best way to do it is with this type. But if you didn't, b'diavad, after the fact, you could do it with any type. Right? Or possibly, I would like to suggest that Gimel and Dalet, 3 and 4, were in the temple. And maybe 2 and 5 are outside of the temple. Right? Right? In the temple, there was hierarchy. There was the specific set fixed ritual that only the Kohanim can do. But post-temple, there's something, dare I say, liberating. I think we're going to see this idea in the fourth chapter, which is why I feel okay to say it. But it isn't as formalized a ritual. And it isn't just the Kohanim that are going to do it. We're going to see at the end of this chapter. And there's more of an equalizer that is going to happen with the Tekiat Shofar that's about everyone and the entire Jewish people, and maybe moving the Tekiat Shofar more to our model of Kiddush HaChodesh, that is a connection between the whole nation working together with the authorities, as opposed to the ritual that happened in the temple. And that when it's outside the temple, I can use any animal. By enabling any animal, maybe I'm including all the experiences that could be of what Rosh Hashanah is all about. And particularly by using the if I want to claim that the main example is Yovel, is the Jubilee, which is an equalizer between human beings, and saying shofar something represents that, that's a very different image than what we saw in the temple. Okay, we're going to keep those ideas with us as we move on. These five Mishnayot really talked about what's the source? What kind of shofar can I use? And therefore tells me something about the style of blast and maybe about the style of blowing. Now we're going to focus on the form or the integrity of the shofar itself. So this is Mishnah Vav. Shofar shenistak v'dibko pasul. Dibek shvarei shofarot pasul. A shofar that is cracked, is broken, and the commentaries understand it like lengthwise. I am even imagining it's kind of like in two halves, and it gets glued together, either with some type of glue or tried to be like smoldered with fire together, is pasul, is ineligible. And here, although this is like slightly different than the flow of 2 to 5, the use of the word pasul, and at the end of this mission of the word kasher that we're going to have, links us back to the language of Mishnah Bet, right? That open kol shofarot are eligible. And then within the category of all those being eligible, now there's certain things that can happen physically to the body of the shofar that says that it's going to make it ineligible. And this issue of wholeness is going to be of integrity, of wholeness, if the natural shofar is important. So if it gets broken and you get glued together, ineligible. If it's just, if you glue together pieces of shofarot, like it wasn't even one whole one, I took half of one shofar and glued it half of the other one, ineligible, pasul. And then it says, nikav ustomo, im, so if there's a hole and then I stuff it up, im ma'akev etatkia, pasul, v'im lav, kasher. If I have a hole and I stuff it up, if it disturbs or blocks or in some ways the sound, the blast, the tikiya, then it's invalid. And if not, it's kasher, it's valid. So here we have that word kasher that brings us back to Mishnah Betz. And this use of if this or this is going to link us to the next Mishnah, Mishnah 7, that language is going to be used. And also this last clause that now is finally in some ways focusing on the sound. We talked about the shape, and I implied that the shape affects the sound. And obviously, we talked about this, that there was a sound, one was longer and one was shorter. But we never really, only in Mishnah Hay did we finally mention the name of the sound. And now we're really like focusing in on the sound. So if this hole somehow disrupts the sound, and here there are two different reads of this Mishnah. The Jerusalem Talmud understands it that the hole, before it gets fixed, If it causes a problem with the sound, then fixing it isn't going to help, and it's going to be pasul, right? Only if I could sound a decent sound without the hole, like even when the hole was there, then I'm allowed to stuff it up and fix that hole because integrity to the body of it, right? The sound was okay originally. The Babylonian Talmud understands that. What does it mean? Once I stuff it up, once I stick up, fix up the hole, right? If then that stuffing up the hole affects the sound, then it's not valid. But if somehow stopping it up created a good sound, then it is valid. So it's a little bit confusing of what happens here. And that seems to be more focused on the body of the shofar itself, right? Fitting that the way the Bavli wants to read it fits with the beginning of the Mishnah that talked about if it was a crack, like so. How much is the body of it affected in some way? Whereas the Yerushalmi's read, which sort of focuses on the original sound, is going to segue us more into the next Mishnah, which is focusing on the sound. Okay, Mishnah Zion. Let's quickly try to do this. Hotokea letoch habor, o letoch hadyot, o letoch hapitam. So one who blows with into a bore, into a cistern or a hole, or latoch, and here there's a girsa difference, what the actual correct text is. Hadyot like this could mean also a cistern or a hole, or there are some versions where it says chadyot, which would means like more like a subterranean room in which you store wine or grain. Either one, there's a similarity that it's some type of hole in the ground, or into some type of jug or flask, right? Im kol shofar shama yatsa. If I'm blowing into one of these, you're gonna see. The other possibility is an echo, right? If I actually hear the actual sound of the shofar, I fulfilled my obligation. So now there's been a switch. Up until now, when it said kasher, pasul, like kosher or ineligible, it was referring to the mitzvah object itself. The shofar itself. Is the shofar a valid shofar or not a valid shofar? Now we find out that actually there's an individual, right? And when we said the mitzvah of the day is with the shofar, we thought that like we were talking about the object. Now we find out that there's an actual individual who has an obligation to fulfill or not fulfill. So if the person hears, so there is someone blowing, but what's interesting is the mitzvah isn't actually on the blowing, although we might have thought it was from this beginning obsession of like what the shofar looks like and et cetera. But the mitzvah is actually on the person who's hearing. So if I hear the actual sound of the shofar, I fulfilled my obligation. V'im kol havra'a shama, but if I only hear an echo, lo yatsa, I have not fulfilled my obligation. So I need to hear the actual sound itself. And then the Mishnah continues. V'chen mi shahaya over achrei beit ha'knesset, o shahaya beito samuch le beit ha'knesset. And so too, similar to this of someone blowing in a pit or someone blowing in a cistern, so too is the same as if someone walked behind a synagogue. So this is the first mention of synagogue, that blowing shofar might happen in a synagogue. We knew it happened in the temple. It could happen if someone's blowing it into a pit or a cistern that doesn't sound like the temple. Some of the early commentators think that that's happening at times when Jews are being persecuted, so they don't want, you know, they need to hide the blowing, and they're hiding in the Bar Kokhba caves or something, and they're blowing the shofar. That's a possible historical understanding of the beginning, but it also moot, right? If it's my first image, I have blowing the shofar in a temple, and then my first image of blowing the shofar like in a subterranean basement or into a pit, those are jarring juxtapositions of imagery, right? It's kind of like the direct opposite of the temple. And then we like move back a little bit towards the temple, but still not the temple, where we find out it gets blown in the Beit HaKnesset, but the person's not in the synagogue. They're passing behind the synagogue, or their house is next to the synagogue, and Kanire, they can't make it out of bed. And then it says, V'shama kol shofar or kol megillah. So the person is passing or is nearby, and they hear the sound of the shofar, or they hear the sound of the Megillah reading on Purim. And both of those things are where the mitzvah is to hear the sound. Im kiv'en libo yatsa, v'im lav lo yatsa. Afal pisha zeshama v'zeshama, ze kiv'en libo v'ze lo kiv'en libo. If he directs his heart, he fulfills his obligation. And if he doesn't, he hasn't fulfilled his obligation. And then the Mishnah says, even though this one hears and that one hears, both people heard, right? I'm walking behind the shul, I can't help but hear the tekiah going. But the difference between someone who just like walks by and hears it and someone who directs their heart, and we have to define what this means, right, is all the entire world, because this one directed their heart and this one didn't. So it's not just, I in the first part of the Mishnah, I learned that I really have to actually hear the sound of the shofar, and that's the mitzvah. In the second part of the Mishnah, I learned that's not everything. Lots of people can hear. But this type of hearing has to be a hearing of intention. And only if it's a hearing of intention have I fulfilled my obligation. And the question is, what the heck does this hearing of intention mean? And the next mission is going to talk about it. This idea of kivein libo is going to be essential. That's where we're going to get to the next mission. That's going to be that agadic Mishnah that I told you about. But I'll just say quickly here that, first of all, the word lave, we say heart. We translate as heart. But in the time period of the rabbis, like the world around them, that the heart was the place where thought happened, right? It's what we would call the mind, they called the heart, right? That's where rational thought happens, that's where feeling happens, etc. I mean, today we still think feeling happens in the heart, where really the heart is just a muscle. And to direct your heart here, I think on the most simple explanation of this Mishnah, it isn't like, you know, intense concentration or really thinking about the divine. I think that's going to come in the next Mishnah. I think here on the most minimal level, we are referring to saying, oh, it's Rosh Hashanah. There's a mitzvah of shofar. When I'm hearing this random thing blowing outside my window, I intend to fulfill my mitzvah. It's an intention of fulfilling the mitzvah, because we hear lots of sounds in the world that come into our ears, but we need to be conscious and understand and make a choice within our hearts, our minds, that this hearing is not just plain hearing, but hearing of a mitzvah action. And this idea we're going to expand on much, 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 much more in our next two classes. The one last thing I want to say in the flow of all this Mishnayot, it's very interesting. We talked about, like, we went from descriptions of the physical shofar, of the outside of the shofar, it's covered in gold or in silver, it has a crack, right, to it going into the ear of the human being, into the body of the human being, the sound, and not only going into its ear, but somehow hitting its heart or its mind with how then the human being reacts or internalizes from that sound. And we're gonna continue with this idea in our next class.
Thank you to our Pardes faculty, and thank you to you, our learners. Make sure to check back in at the beginning of each week to stay on track with your Elul learning. And visit www.pardes.org.il for more information about Pardes and our programs.